The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
I'm Catherine Pompilio with an episode from the Lawfare Archive for March 12, 2022. We're now 2 weeks into Russia's invasion of Ukraine. This week, the U.S. banned the import of Russian energy resources. Moscow is recruiting Syrian fighters skilled in urban combat to send to Kyiv. And the International Criminal Court announced it would open an investigation into potential war crimes stemming from the conflict. Could we have seen the Russian invasion of Ukraine coming? What were the political and economic postures of countries in Eastern Europe just 2 years ago? And how does that inform what we know about the conflict today? To answer these questions, I chose an archive episode from November 2020. In the episode, Ben Wittes sat down with Lieutenant Colonel, retired, Alex Vindman, to discuss how democracies in Eastern Europe can hang together and harden themselves against attacks from authoritarian regimes. They also spoke about what a good Russia policy looked like for the Biden administration in 2020, and how we can rebuild traditional American alliances.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, November 20th, 2020. Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman, retired, is now the Pritzker Military Fellow at the Lawfare Institute, the newest member of the Lawfare team. You've heard his story in 100 places, including in his own testimony in the impeachment proceedings last year for President Trump. But we had him on the podcast today for a different reason, because of his substantive expertise in Eastern Europe policy, Russia matters, and great power competition. What are the challenges that the Biden administration is going to face as it tries to pick up the pieces the Trump administration has left it? How can democracies hang together and harden themselves against attacks from authoritarian regimes? What does a good Russia policy look like? How does China fit in? And how can we rebuild traditional American alliances? It's the Lawfare Podcast, November 20th. Alex Vindman talks Eastern Europe. Hey, folks, quick note before we get started. Alex Vindman will be joining us on Lawfare Live today, that is to say Friday, at noon to take your questions on Lawfare Live. Lawfare Live is reserved for our Patreon supporters, but no matter if you're not one of them, you can become one. We'll be live at noon with Alexander Vindman today. Alex, I want to start with your sense of what an incoming Biden administration will see when they look at Eastern Europe, Russia, and sort of the problems of great power competition.
Sure. Thanks, Ben. First of all, let me thank you and Lawfare for your support and for giving me an opportunity to participate. And I guess this will be an inaugural Lawfare podcast. So thanks again.
Indeed. And welcome to the crew.
Yeah. So let's see. That's a small question. I mean, I could probably answer that one pretty quickly. now, the host of challenges is going to be significant. Probably one of the reasons that it's going to be as big as they are is the last 4 years have really kind of weakened the U.S. Position in the world, undermined U.S. credibility. And I think the domestic challenges of the Biden administration will be enormous to rebuild, to really arrest the decline, and then to rebuild the integrity and the trust in institutions. It's going to be harder than it is today, because for the next 60 days or so, we will have a president and unfortunately, probably even a Republican Party that's complicit with the president's efforts to undermine the fundamental institutions that support our democracy. The whole notion of a peaceful transition of power is lost on this president. I think traditionally parties recognize that they'll have another bite at the apple in the future if they are able to entice enough voters to come back to their policy views, their views of the world. This president, you know, doesn't see the world in the same way. It's the only thing he cares about is the loss of the world. So lots of challenges domestically. What does that mean internationally? It means that we are relatively weaker and our adversaries are relatively stronger. Our alliances that are in fact a significant multiplier effect on U.S. power are weakened, and specifically with regards to Russia and its interests, they're being extremely well served at the moment by a president that is basically challenging this notion of both U.S. leadership and democracy as kind of a viable form of governance. And I think that they do that for multiple reasons. One of them is it's a good way to distract and prevent U.S. attention from turning to overseas challenges if the U.S. is focused domestically. It allows the Russians, in particular in Eastern Europe, to continue to use coercive tools and compel desired outcomes, whether that's through use of force. We've seen that play out a couple times already. Georgia, Ukraine, both in Crimea and Donbass, and then through hybrid tools, cyber operations, illicit finance networks, all sorts of different things. And then that obviously, between the two preeminent authoritarian states, the Chinese are also benefiting from this very sullied view of the United States. So a lot of challenges that we're going to face. And I think the first step is going to be to start to think about how we pull together the democracies to harden themselves and become more resilient to these types of attacks.
All right, so let's break that down. There's a lot of themes there, and let's talk about them individually. So the first question it's not the first question that you raised, but it's the first one I want to talk about, is the sort of lure of authoritarian regimes relative to democratic regimes. Obviously, we have had our own flirtations with that over the last several years. But if you're going to get the democracies to, in a meaningful sense, harden themselves and stand together, they got to have confidence that you are going to remain in that camp, which is where the domestic side of this and the international side crash into each other. So if you were in your prior position or in the State Department, and you know, you were trying to talk to the Eastern European countries, some of whom are more democratic at this point than others, frankly, and you were trying to get them together in a sort of hardening democracies against external pressure kind of way, what would you be saying to them, given that their reasonable response might be, who are you guys to talk to us about that?
So I think we would tend to get more of that kind of response from countries that are backsliding and countries that are kind of in the authoritarian camp rather than our allies. Our allies actually would have consistently remained loyal to this notion of the United States that plays a positive, affirmative role in advancing the interests of democracy. So I'm not sure how much we have to sell ourselves on this notion, except the underlying fact that, you know, we could have a reversal for 4 years. So do we engage in long-term projects, or do we try to do, you know, relatively transactional activities to advance the interests of democracy in a four-year stint, recognizing that, again, there could be reversals. I think what aids us in this is both Eastern Europe and Western Europe, frankly, democracies as a whole, face many of the same challenges. They face the rise of what I called isms. So that's their own forms of systemic racism, populism, ethnocentric nationalism that exist even absent the efforts of adversaries to exploit them. And there are a number of other kinds of challenges, inequality, growing inequality between the haves and the have-nots, the inefficient distribution of wealth and benefits from globalization and so forth that the United States and other democracies will face. So I think there's a project, a natural project, where the United States and these other democracies could start to collaborate on solutions that might not be applicable to all in the same way, but there is a symmetry in the kinds of solutions that we could all share. And basically taking those types of solutions is probably the best thing we could do to harden ourselves against the rise of authoritarian states that are using different kinds of tools, both coercive tools and enticements to undermine established democracies, emerging democracies, struggling democracies. It's the internal solutions that are going to be deterministic of success rather than kind of just focusing on punishing Russia or China for their malign influence. So that's the first thing. I think there's a project in hand, and I'm actually writing an article on this currently, on this idea of U.S. taking a leadership role in pulling together the democracies to solve democracies' internal challenges as well as the assault from authoritarian states. And then, of course, just a minute on the external issues. I think there has to be a high degree of pragmatism. Frankly, we shouldn't be looking to pick a fight with great powers, and indicate that there would be some sort of effort towards regime change. I think it should be a much more sophisticated view of areas where there is going to be a cooperation, areas and areas that we're going to disagree on, where we'll continue to advocate for democratic principles, but at the same time, not seek regime change. And we in fact have the benefit of our ideological view that the arc of history will bend towards democracy. Things will move in that direction. We will continue to support the transparency, the institution building required for democracies, but we don't have to do that through some sort of acute regime change. What we do have to do, though, is when our democracies are attacked by malign influence, we need to consider reciprocity. And the fact that as distasteful as it is, and as consistent as we are in applying a principle-based approach, our adversaries are not. They see the world in a zero-sum game. We'll have to do something to establish deterrence and prevent these authoritarian powers from interfering in our internal affairs. And that very well may be something along the lines of fighting fire with fire.
All right. So those are some important kind of ideational substrata of policy, but it's more thematic than it is policy. So let's bring it down to brass tacks. You are now the Biden administration that has coming in, or you're whispering in the ear of the president as he comes in. You're, for obvious reasons, acutely aware of what has not happened over the last 4 years, and also what has happened over the last 4 years, positive and negative. And so the president turns to you and says, Alex, let's look at your region and figure out what's the low-hanging fruit that we should be doing differently with respect to Russia, but also with respect to supporting democracies in Eastern Europe and encouraging those countries that are engaged in democratic backsliding to, put some sandpaper on their butts and slow down or reverse themselves. What does the first 6 months of a different Eastern Europe policy look like to you?
Sure. So I think from a realistic standpoint, I think the first 6 months are going to have to be collaborating to in the next 6 months, because again, I'm realistic about the kinds of challenges we face domestically. But within a year time frame, organize a, and this is not a new thought, but organize a democracy summit and bring together, and I think we would have an enormous amount of interest and a lot of willing partners to participate in this kind of summit, where we pull together the democracies. There is a effort to generate a, just like we've done with regards to Russia and you know, the whales summit and so forth, generate a common view of the threat perceptions of Russia. Do the same thing for the threat to democracy. And emerging from that, have a series of solutions that could help address the challenges to democracies. I think part of these solutions are going to be a look at how information flows and how our adversaries take advantage of free and open information channels to insert disinformation that undermines the notion of kind of a truth narrative, an absolute truth, and something that potentially gets democracies to question kind of very foundational and fundamental ideas about democracy. So I think there's going to have to be an information component to it. I think illicit finance is going to have to be another component that, again, the U.S. and all democracies, I don't think this is a problem just for Eastern Europe. This is a problem for the U.K. It's a problem for France, Greece, many, many places. But look at illicit finance and how illicit finance flows promote some sort of extreme polarization by supporting, you know, far right, far left parties and things of that nature. So that's a second thing, information, illicit finance. I think another idea would be a notion of how do you support struggling democracies. There's quite a bit that could be done with regards to aid, I think. And there are different kinds of categories of struggling democracies. There are democracies that are backsliding. Hungary, Turkey, Poland right now are backsliding. They will be less willing to do that. And then there are struggling democracies that actually are facing the challenges of, let's say, for instance, Russia in Ukraine, that want our help and are looking for assistance and are willing partners. So there are different solutions for each one of those. And we shouldn't kind of neglect the very draw of luster of China and Chinese style of prosperity and what that does for struggling democracies that are trying to determine whether they want to move down the road of, you know, the Western liberal order or take some shortcuts to prosperity and run their governments and something closer to China. So that's another very difficult challenge that we'll have to face.
All right. So in this democracy summit, who do you include and exclude? Because there are these countries, and you mentioned Hungary and Poland and Turkey, so let's think about those, that are kind of nominally democratic, but have Poland is less far down the urbanization slide than Hungary is. But Erdogan is both elected and quite the strong man at this point. Is the goal of this kind of summit to include our traditional allies who may be treaty allies, but are also, you know, not model democracies at this point? Or is the goal to exclude them and thus to, you know, say, look, you want to be part of this club, there are responsibilities as well as benefits, and we're not going to pretend that all elected governments are created equal here?
Yeah. You know, my thought would be to not exclude anyone per se. I think even Russia and China can be there in some sort of role as observers. I think the fear that they have is that these enterprises would automatically be geared on regime change and destabilizing non-democracies. And there's going to be, they won't believe what we say. They probably won't even believe our actions. They believe that's probably what we're doing now. But at least there's some transparency in offering them an opportunity to, you know, participate in some way as observers. You know, that obviously points to this notion that we would include all our existing treaty allies. What I would suggest is that we don't look for consensus-based solutions. Maybe it could be something along the lines of coalition of the willing. And I have a feeling that coalition would be enormous and that would want to participate in, basically identifying solutions and potentially even burden sharing, which is a high bar for us. We no longer can carry the burden of basically defending the democracy on our own. The numbers, economics don't lend to that. So I think we frankly look at solutions where everybody is able to participate. The outputs could be, it would be of course ideal if there's some sort of compact that comes out. But if it becomes watered down because of the fact that we need to achieve consensus with everyone, I don't think that's the case. I think what we do is, you know, we look, it's an exchange of best practices fundamentally. So we look at solutions and a coalition of the willing to advance this notion. And this would probably be the first of a series of democracy summits in which we kind of assess where we are, where we're doing. I think there's something to be said about, you know, coming up with an idea of whether democracies are doing better in aggregate and then constituent states are doing better in aggregate a year down the road, a couple of years down the road. So there's a score sheet associated with that. There's probably also some sort of way to assess whether we've advanced the interests of democracy more broadly or whether, you know, democracy continues to decline as it has seemingly has over the past decade or two. So I don't think this is, you know, transparency alone dictates that we go with more rather than less, and then come up with some means where, again, we don't water down solutions. If we're not calling out in the first iteration individual states like Hungary and Turkey and Poland, and we're just talking about, you know, what challenges the countries face, again, we'll find quite a bit of commonality.
And if they don't want to sign certain communiques and certain commitments or certain statements of best practices, that will speak for itself?
That's exactly what I'm suggesting, is that they would want to participate and continue to burnish their credibility as democratic states and part of their democratic community.
So the goal is less to create specific international legal obligations than it is to actually actively speak on behalf of democracy again, to sort of make democracy cool again.
I think so. It's interesting in drafting this this paper that I'm working on. I was startled by some very quick stats that I compiled. I looked at two things, basically the number of democratic states versus authoritarian states, and the numbers have definitely been shifting away from democracy towards authoritarianism. And then I looked at kind of the economic horsepower behind democratic states. And what I discovered is, I took two measures, one in 2019 and one in 1992. In 1992, when the U.S. was at the height of its power, unipolar world, the Soviet Union had collapsed, 94% of the wealth resided amongst democracies. That's in the G20. I try to use a manageable number amongst the G20. Now, some 30 years later, just about 38% of that wealth is now with authoritarian states. So you have the remainder 62% is with democracies. That's an enormous shift. That's an enormous shift towards authoritarian states and the kind of the capability that enables for authoritarian states. But it also points to the fact that, again, the United States can't hold and defend democracy by itself. It has to be a concerted effort by the other democracies in the world that can help come up with a series of solutions and meet this challenge.
All right. So let's talk about two prominent non-democratic leaders who are, say, not encompassed in this vision. One is Vladimir Putin and the other is Xi Jinping. And you had said that one thing we, you know, should be thinking about is forms of confrontation that don't threaten regime change. We have, of course, no capacity to change the Chinese regime and realistically no capacity to change the Russian regime either. If in the first 6 months you're planning a sort of democracy gathering in the second 6 months, what does the first 6 months of Russia policy consist of? Presumably merely not having Helsinki-type summits or, praise of the president of Russia is itself a significant change, but the policy isn't composed simply of the absence of the egregious aspects of the former policy. What does a first year of a Biden administration with respect to Russia look like?
Yeah, I think from the Russian side, the Russian perspective, there'll be kind of a feel out period. I think from the U.S. side, we're likely to put feelers out to see if there is some sort of accommodation to be made, but with the understanding that that's not likely and that there'll be a need to kind of ratchet up pressure to deter Russian aggression and malign influence. From the Russian side, on the other hand, I think they're going to try to figure out what is Biden administration mean for them. And they'll probably take, as they often do, they'll take their cue off of U.S. actions. So if we, in putting out our feelers to the Russians to identify that the rules have changed and there will be a more significant cost imposed for Russian aggression, malign influence, and that's basically something like the sort of Damocles kind of over their heads as a warning rather than an immediate cost that's imposed, I think we're likely to potentially see a much more cautious Russia. If we immediately respond with kind of a host of sanctions, in some ways, I think you could really justify and say that they're warranted. The Russians have been behind the scenes, seeking to undermine democracy in the United States and Europe. So it's warranted, but that's likely to result in kind of an escalation and a more acute relationship with the Russians. So I think there should be two parallel tracks that are pursued. One is a frank conversation with the Russians, and it doesn't have to, of course, you know, the decisions are made in the Russian system at chief executive level, so Putin, but that's not going to happen with Biden anytime soon. So you have to kind of trust and empower subordinates, probably like the Secretary of State, the National Security Advisor, to have those frank conversations with Vladimir Putin, kind of indicate that the rules have changed and the consequences could be high for Russian aggression. They'll deny it. They'll say we haven't been doing anything wrong, but they will take the warning and likely, you know, adjust their actions accordingly. At the same time, we should be preparing for the eventuality, the possibility of a much more confrontational relationship with Russia in marshaling our forces. Those are going to be kind of the standard toolkit that we've employed, maybe to excess with regards to sanctions. I say to excess because I think it's to the sanctions were used to the exclusion of other tools, but potentially looking at, you know, again, imposing a cost, almost like a reciprocal action for Russian aggression. Now, I'm not advocating for us to stoop to their level per se, but in order to achieve deterrence, we potentially may have to take a look at a response to Russian interference in U.S. domestic or Western politics by something along the lines of kind of targeted messaging campaigns to the Russian population. They're not all that dissimilar to what we did in the Cold War. And it's not where we want to be. It's not where, you know, our Western liberal mindset feels most comfortable, especially after the fall of the Soviet Union and the end of communism. But it's something that we really seriously need to consider to, again, achieve deterrence.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hey, Lawfare listeners, Ben Wittes here. I want to tell you about the first time I got a report from the folks at Delete Me. It was shortly after I started using the service back in 2022, and they sent me their first privacy report. I have since gotten 8 others, and it contained some shocking information. They had removed my data from 56 separate data brokers, that this had included 133 separate records, including 621 individual pieces of personal information. The data broker with the most information about me was a company I'd never heard of called People by Name. And here's the thing. Since then, every couple of months, I've gotten another privacy report from Delete Me, and it always contains more information that they have removed from the data brokers about me. In the second report, they informed me they had removed my stuff from 41 data brokers, and that the one with the most information about me was called Hleck. I have no idea what Hleck is. So the other day, I got my latest report, and it includes 15 more data brokers with my personal information, 113 pieces of personally identifiable information. Big culprit this time is something called My Life. Well, I want to tell you that they don't have My Life anymore. And that is why I recommend Delete Me. As this little anecdote shows, there's a lot of my data out there, and these companies keep acquiring it and making it available to anybody who can pay. And I have slept a little bit more easily ever since I found a solution to this problem. And I want to stress, as I do every time, that I started using this before Delete Me started advertising with Lawfare. Delete Me finds and removes any personal information you don't want online, and it makes sure it stays off. And that's the point of this little story, that, you know, they keep coming back. You can get it removed once, but they'll put it back. And then Delete Me comes and takes it off again. It's a subscription service that removes your personal information from the largest people search databases on the web, and in the process helps prevent potential identity theft, doxing, and phishing scams. Delete Me sends you regular personalized privacy reports, just like the ones I've been describing, showing what info they found where they found it, and what they removed. And critically, as this story reflects, it isn't just a one-time service. It's always working for you, constantly monitoring and removing the personal information you don't want on the internet. It does all the hard work of wiping you and your family's personal information off the web. Data brokers hate Delete Me, which is why I like it. Your profile is no longer theirs to sell. So take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me, now at a special discount for our listeners. Today, get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and use promo code lawfare20 at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and enter code LAWFARE20 at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/LAWFARE20, code LAWFARE20. So I'm trying to think about what that looks like in practice. So there are two states in Eastern Europe where I think are plausible flashpoints for, you know, sort of an early effort to test what you're talking about and to sort of establish that there's a new sheriff in town and there are new rules as well. One is Ukraine, of course, where there is a, you know, ongoing conflict. And the other is Belarus, where, of course, the Russian-backed dictator Lukashenko has been, in fact, defeated in an election, and unlike Donald Trump, is capable of remaining in power despite that fact. You know, it is now January 20th, and you are Joe Biden looking at these two places where the U.S. is in, you know, sort of dialogue about democracy with Russia in an ongoing fashion. What do you do?
Right. So I think, both of those are extremely challenging, but out of the two, I guess I'll start with the slightly easier one, Belarus. The reason I say it's slightly easier is because Putin and Russia still enjoy a high level of support amongst the Belarusian population. It's not a rejection of kind of, you know, the Russian mindset per se. It's a rejection, explicit rejection of Lukashenko and his continued rule. So there's a solution in hand in which, you know, Lukashenko is no longer in power. A new government comes in that is, you know, maybe a little bit less reliable to Russia. Lukashenko hasn't been entirely reliable, but at least he's kind of, again, shares the same kind of worldview. You know, and with democracy, there are some risks potentially for the Russians. But somebody that there is a new leadership that's still, again, favorably disposed to the Russians, but is not Lukashenko. So that's what I think the ultimate solution, if Lukashenko leaves, is going to look like. And I say if, it's because in spite of the fact that, you know, you have a really an enormous amount of bravery from the population resisting security crackdowns, time tends to be on the side of the dictator, using security service to suppress rather than the side of the protesters that eventually kind of, start to believe that, you know, they're just not receiving effects. They're not likely to achieve an outcome and only expose themselves to greater risk. So there is a significant risk. Where the U.S. could play a constructive role is in declaring a support for, you know, a democratic resolution to Belarus and transition government without necessarily even indicating that there's some sort of a roadmap to joining the EU or any of the security structures, you know, most importantly, NATO. So I think there's some sort of there's a step to be taken there. And then, of course, there's a number of conversations to be had with the Russians behind the scenes on a host of issues, amongst which you'll discuss Belarus, Ukraine, Middle East, Venezuela, arms control, a whole bunch of different things. But Belarus would be, you know, if it hadn't been in that list when I was in the NSC and participating in National Security Advisor conversations with his Russian counterparts, it would obviously be one now. So I think there's something to be said there. With regards to Ukraine, it's a difficult challenge. And I think really the way out of this particular confrontation is the West, including the United States, providing much, much stronger support to Ukraine. And that support actually comes with significant strings attached. There has been, I think, largely, or at least in part, due to inattention by the United States and, frankly, the U.S. indicating that it is no longer in favor of, you know, anti-corruption efforts or providing a alternative example, President Zelensky has not shown or has not been able to kind of address foundational issues with regards to Ukraine and its struggle for reforms and democracy. Part of those have been rollback in transparency efforts. There's a kind of an e-registration of assets to prevent corruption amongst politicians and so forth. There have been some reversals there that with U.S. and EU support can, again, I guess, undergird or add some strength to Zelensky's efforts in that regard. And at the same time, there could be some aid that's rendered that, again, puts Ukraine on a path towards prosperity. And it's prosperity ultimately itself that's going to make the cost of continued involvement in Ukraine particularly high. The example that, you know, Ukraine prosperity sets for Eastern Ukraine and ultimately for Crimea, that'll be much more important than, you know, the force of arms or something of that nature. But we should also not omit, you know, potentially providing additional military support, security assistance to, again, strengthen the Ukrainian hand. And that's going to cause some issues with the Russians, but it's just a reality, something that we probably need to do.
Is Zelensky still one of the good guys, or has he become, you know, part of the system that he ran against.
Yeah. I don't know if I would describe him as part of the system he ran against. I would say that he's been less effective than certainly, the Westwood Hope and that population hoped for. They just recently had local elections and his party was, you know, was beaten handedly. That is probably the best signal of, you know, how well he's performing, and he's underperforming at the moment. But again, we shouldn't underestimate the bad example that the Trump administration provided on anti-corruption efforts and how that probably really undermined Zelensky's ability to get things done. We had a lot of hopes on what we could do, and we put together, I was able to lead an effort to put together a plan to support anti-corruption reform efforts, some sector-related engagements, you know, to help build the budgetary support for some of the initiatives. So, you know, that was in the form of energy and economic cooperation, security assistance, and we were not able to implement those. And this happened during a time where Zelensky, although he had a very popular, he had a popular mandate and he won by landslides, him and his party won by landslides, he was still facing enormous internal headwinds with regards to oligarchs and corrupt interests holding the kind of the preponderance of the power. So I think he's definitely underperformed, but he's only 1 year into a 5 year tenure. So I think there's still plenty of opportunity to reverse course, and we could help him. We could help him do that.
So if Joe Biden, very early in his presidency, has that White House meeting with Zelensky that the Ukrainians were seeking from the time of Zelensky's election, and of course was famously held hostage to opening an investigation of Joe Biden and Hunter Biden. If Joe Biden were to come into office, immediately invite Zelensky to the White House and talk about and prioritize precisely the anti-corruption stuff that Zelensky campaigned on, that everybody except in the U.S. government, except the president and Rudy Giuliani, were excited to have him working on and to work with him on, and we were to kind of, to coin a phrase, hit a reset button in our relationship with the Zelensky presidency, is it too late for that to be effective, or is that still a path forward for U.S. and Ukraine?
I think it absolutely is a path forward. I think, it's hard to imagine amongst the various parties that it'll be kind of the first meeting that President Biden has. But I would imagine that sometime in the first 6 months, there is likely to be a meeting between President Zelensky and President Biden. You know, behind the scenes, supporting that meeting would be a series of initiatives that, you know, we will have already made progress on. And with more high bar objectives over the longer term, that would support this kind of meeting. And I can't say this Vice President-elect Kamala Harris would necessarily fill this role, but Vice President Biden filled a kind of a unique role, frequently traveling to Ukraine to support the Poroshenko administration as they were kind of facing the challenges of a war with Russia. I would like to see some key leader engagement that is able to, on a regular basis, engage with the Ukrainians, you know, take this kind of forward-looking view on and advancing the outputs of this democracy summit. Probably the biggest challenge to that, of course, is that, you know, we still have a Senate that's undecided, and at the best case scenario is a 50-50 outcome come the first week of January, and then you would have to have the vice president preside as the president of the Senate in order to get things done, which really limits her ability to potentially engage overseas and fill the same role that Vice President Biden did. But I'd like to see maybe that could be a Secretary of State, it could be a National Security Advisor, it could be a you know, it could be a very empowered deputy or assistant secretary that's that, you know, basically takes that as one of the key areas of focus to really help usher in a much more effective integration of Ukraine into the EU, into the West, and, you know, with all the underlying requirements to do so. I think it's realistic. I think it's certainly realistic to for something like that to happen in the first 6 months. The bar for that would be, it wouldn't be just a meeting for the sake of having a meeting. It would have to have a number of, you know, accomplishments and deliverables emerging from that. And it would need a consistent level of attention from the United States to support that. And I see this as a supporting element to this democracy summit project.
All right, let's talk about Xi Jinping. So unlike Vladimir Putin, who really does not propose a model internationally, he's kind of a great power troll. China does have a model that they're exporting, and they're exporting it pretty aggressively. It is less salient in your neck of the woods, but, you know, from a great power competition point of view, presumably the Biden administration does not come in with a, hey, let's have a sort of multiple personality disorder approach to China, in which we, on one level, praise Xi Jinping and insist that he is doing the right thing with Uyghurs, and also decry the virus as a Chinese export. So how do you understand the aspect of your democratic consolidation concerns and interests as pertains to China, which of course will be our principal geopolitical rival, notwithstanding our quite reasonable obsession with Russia?
Sure. So this is probably not the best way to put it. It's not to the Trump administration's credit, but as a result of the administration, the Trump administration, the relationship with China is probably forever changed. And one of the benefits is that there is a much more kind of realistic view of the threat of China, of China's emergence that, you know, both parties now share. Now, does that need to automatically devolve into a hostile and confrontational relationship? No, it does not. I don't think it does. But it does mean that there will be certain features of the relationship that will become far more challenging. So China's efforts to use its economic power to extract concessions from Western business, and the views on that are that, you know, this is a key issue, theft of intellectual property. This is not something that's going to be reversed. I mean, there's not going to be a return to some sort of benign view of the rise of China. And I think as a result of that, even in this democracy summit, there'll be an effort to understand that China is using its enormous wealth to, you know, entice. Oftentimes, it's entice, not just coerce, not just engage in corrupt practices, but oftentimes it's entice. It's the benefits of, you know, working with China and keeping China, you know, on sides that actually allows China to achieve its outcomes. It's this notion that if you run afoul of China, your economic relationship can be irreparably harmed. And we've seen this play out, you know, in Norway over the nomination of a Chinese dissident as a Nobel laureate, or in the Pacific Islands with Pacific Island nations not supporting China's enterprise to isolate Taiwan. That's the punishment side. But there's, I think, maybe more importantly, the kind of the side of the equation where China's wealth and the prosperity that a positive relationship can bring to a country is maybe the more, you know, overriding factor. So I think these are challenges that the United States and other democracies are going to have to face. China, because of its disproportionate power, tends to use that power on a bilateral basis, and it uses it effectively. I gave you a couple of examples. It's doing the same thing with regards to an emerging backlash in Australia over Chinese malign influence. It's able to do that on a bilateral basis. I think the future is a world in which there is something at least slightly more closely hewing to NATO, for instance, where you could bring in your alliance structure to balance out against China's malign influence. That is much, much easier to do in the security sphere, where you could have a burgeoning Quad alliance between the US, Australia, India, Japan, to push back on kind of excessive claims for China. It becomes much more challenging in the economic sphere because, again, China has enormous wealth, and you can't easily offset that by, you know, one, two, or three countries that have interests elsewhere going in and, you know, replacing the loss of engagement with China. But that's a reality that is going to have to be faced, because it's more than likely that the challenges that our allies will have with China are not going to be in the security sphere. There'll be some of that. It's the economic sphere that we're going to have to deal with. And less acute than Russia, the information sphere, where the Chinese are using their wealth to purchase news networks and airtime to promote the idea of China as kind of a benevolent actor, and diplomatic sphere also. So it's a much more challenging issue because it's all elements of statecraft that we're going to have to try to deal with regards to China.
Finally, I want to talk about traditional U.S. military alliances, in particular NATO, but also, it's worth thinking about South Korea with respect to China. These alliances have taken a real beating over the last 4 years, and confidence in the U.S. and whether we will be there when it counts is really down. Some of the countries in question are more unambiguously democratic than others. Turkey, of course, is a prominent NATO member. What do you do to reassure traditional treaty allies, quite apart from democracy as such, but our traditional treaty allies, that the U.S. is back in its traditional role?
That's not an easy problem because, again, you may very well earn the confidence of our allies that the next 4 years will be kind of a return to normalcy. But that doesn't mean that, the subsequent 4 years won't be kind of a return to a malignancy of the Trump era. So I think what you probably need to do in this kind of situation is you need to make the foundation strong, regardless of kind of what administrations of power. And one of the things that the U.S. will continue to do under less provocatively and less aggressively is pursue this notion of burden sharing and the fact that we and our allies need to more equitably share the load of collective defense and security, provision of regional security. I would say that a continuing trajectory on our allies making, their 2% obligations in with regards to NATO, burden sharing with our allies in the Pacific, is kind of the foundation that we need to move forward on. Separately, there are plenty of things we could do kind of on the operational and tactical level. We'll continue to advance interoperability, integration of systems, and so forth that will just make us more effective and a harder target for adversaries. I think you hit on the kind of the biggest challenge. It's by far the political challenge and the absence of certainty for our allies on, what kind of nation the United States is. I think, again, a democracy project of the kind I've articulated makes good headway in terms of underscoring the kind of nation we are, the kind of challenges we need to face that could prevent a reversion back to, the malignancy of a Trump era. There are, what I would call legitimate and illegitimate grievances within states. The isms are a category of not legitimate grievances that still need to be addressed. And then the legitimate ones are, inequality, polarization, the urban-rural divides, and so forth that we could potentially collaborate with our allies on.
Alex Vindman, Welcome to Lawfare, and thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure, Ben. Looking forward to having more of these in the future.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Our audio engineer this episode is the long-suffering Zachary Frank of Goat Rodeo. You should do your part to promote the Lawfare podcast. Tweet about us, share us on Facebook, upvote us on Reddit, pin us on Pinterest, and make TikTok videos about us if you have downloaded TikTok, which you most certainly should not do. The Lawfare podcast is produced and edited by Jen Patya Howell. Our music is performed by the one and only Sophia Yan. And as always, thanks for listening.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.